Today is August the 9th. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King, and we're in the studio of PRN.FM. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and normally on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, and the program is live streamed on BAI.org at 9 p.m. However, this program is available on PRN.FM on our website. The podcast of it is, and the regular program will always be available each week. Tonight, WBAI is in a membership drive, and we will not be on. They will be on with a different program. And tonight, Joe, I just want to tell you, when I was growing up, I had a library card, and I remember the library card. You know, you go to the library, and you give the library, you pick out four books. That was a maximum, and you go up to the desk, and you show them the card, and they check out the book. And if you returned the book late, it was a penny a day for each book that you didn't return. But the library card is no longer the library card that we know of, huh?
Oh, the library card is exactly the same. The books, not quite. And the other things you can get with the library card, you know, it reminds me of my nephew, who is now in his early 30s. But when he was a very little boy, he turned to me and said, "Uncle Jay, what was your favorite TV program when you were growing up?" And I said, "Ian, they didn't have TV then.
It was a radio."
And he said, "What do you mean they didn't have TV? You mean your daddy didn't buy you a TV set?" I said, "It hadn't been invented yet, Ian." He could not accept that. Well, today, it's the same thing.
Well, actually, the TV was invented in the 1930s by Farnsworth.
By
1937.
The first TV show actually was on...
In the late 40s with The Gorgeous George, I remember.
No, it was long before
long
that.
Long before that?
Yeah, the 1939 World Series had TV sets, but I didn't.
Well, let's tell the people what's so different about the library.
Well, the library today is not just for books. It's for anything that's digital.
There was a big announcement made last week.
There was, and Hank, I was shocked when you called me up and said, "Did I know about Canopy?" And I said...
Wait, how do you spell that? Canopy?
No.
No?
That Canopy I knew about.
Okay.
This Canopy was Canopy, Canopy. And the other Canopy that you specified was a piece of cloth you had to buy and stretch over the door. It cost money. This Canopy doesn't cost a damn thing. You just, if you have a library card right now from in this area, from the Brooklyn or the New York public libraries, it's honored by Canopy. So far, the Queens Public Library hasn't gotten it, but here's the good, Queens will be getting it, but here's the good thing about Canopy. I'll tell you what Canopy is a little bit later, but right now, if your public library, wherever you live, does not offer Canopy, the head librarian can get it at no cost, just contacting Canopy. And what Canopy is, Hank, it's a catalog of some 30,000 downloadable video programs. There's movies, there's documentaries, there's TV programming. One of the things that it has that I really like myself is it has all the great books. You've heard of that program.
No, wait a minute. I remember a long time ago you would borrow a book from the library, and then I know about 10, 15 years ago they had these DVDs and CDs that you could borrow. Now you're saying you don't even have to – there's no physical DVD and CDs anymore?
You don't have to go to the library.
You mean I have to wait online anymore?
You don't have to put on your underwear. You can stay right commando the way you normally walk around the house.
Well, have you looked at what is available? Is it stuff that really, like, it's so old you don't really want to do anything with it?
Yes and no. I'm opening it right now. I'm looking at it. Popular documentaries, new-to-Canopy movies, new-to-Canopy documentaries, independent films, world cinema, trending now, films starring certain actors, favorites of the audience, New York Times critic picks, fun films for the summer, and it goes on and on and on and on. three of my favorite movies are showing up here on the default classic cinema page: Bicycle Thieves, Breathless, and Rashomon. Here in the great courses, you can take all of I think the great courses were originally started by Encyclopedia Britannica, but all the...
Joe, let me just interrupt you and ask you, do you need a PC to do this or some computer to do this?
You need a computer, you need a PC, you need an MP3, MP4 player. You need something that can play a streamed video from download.
Now, wait a minute. Suppose I have iOS or Android or even Roku devices.
Roku, I'm not sure about, but you definitely can use iOS, Android, Windows. I'm not sure about Roku. Right?
Well, how many movies can you download? You could download 100 at a time? Or
I think you can download 10 at a time.
Oh, 10 per month, I think it says. And now, what got me is that you have 3 days to finish watching them. I don't understand that. You only have three days, and then it disappears. You can't download it?
No, after 3 days, it is auto-erased from your drive.
Oh, you really think that will happen?
Oh, it will happen, but can you get it back? Let me just tell you something. I borrow books from the library, e-books, and they give me, depending on the book, up to 28 days. And at the end of the 28 days, if you try to access that book, it says your book has run out. Do you want to erase it now? And you have a yes or a no. If you say yes, it's erased. If you say no, the next time you try to open the book, the same message comes up. Now, if you know that message is going to come up, you don't access the book. You set back the automatic date on time on your computer or your device, and it won't ask you that anymore. But don't make the mistake of setting up the date or time before the first time you had the book, because it'll screw everything up.
Oh, okay. Well, it seems like you've been having fun with it, Joe.
I've had great fun with this. And you know, if I had no other purpose on my smartphone, if I only had my smartphone as a phone and this one-item canopy, I'd be perfectly happy.
Well, let me ask you then, you can download music too?
Yes, I can download music from the New York Public Library, but not from Canopy.
Well, one of the announcements that Apple made was that they're discontinuing the selling of the Nano and the Shuffle, and that to me is MP3 music you can use on it. And I feel like saying, gee, wouldn't it be nice if I can go to the library and download it onto a little Nano device instead of worry about using a smartphone and drain the battery on it?
You can.
But Apple's not going to be selling it anymore.
No, but SanDisk is, and Brand X is. I can get an MP3 player for $25.
Wait.
I don't need a
we
Nano.
We have to tell the people that Apple made the announcement that they're dropping the Nano and the Shuffle. I forgot to mention that.
I appreciate that. And do you know that India has passed a law that I think by the mid-century, I'm not sure of the exact date, but that law has already been passed that by that date you cannot sell a car except an electric car. Does that mean General Motors should stop selling all their cars?
Well, I do know that back in the mid-80s, we had a 1967 car that needed leaded fuel, and we managed to run it for another 5-6 years.
Well, you could. Without the lead in the fuel, you'll cause what's called an engine ping.
Or a knock.
It's a pre-ignition. The lead slows down the explosion that takes place in an internal combustion engine. But that's another problem. Here, Apple has discontinued something that basically they promulgated. Before the Apple iPod and Nano, you did have a Walkman. And the Walkman, as you may recall, played a cassette tape.
Well, there was a Walkman recorder, I remember.
Yes, and I owned one. I owned two. I think I still have one someplace.
Well, I got to give you a little short story on this, because back in the 1980s, I've been trying to get a one-on-one interview with Bill Gates, and not on the phone, but eyeball to eyeball, and And I was at Comdex, and...
What year was that?
1986. And I was at Comdex, and I get a call from the PR people saying, you want to interview him? I said, yes. Well, he's available now. I had no recorder, so I'm looking for a cheap... Remember, that's only cassette recorders then.
Yes.
So I think I bought a Sony cassette recorder, and it's a great interview. I'm going to be playing it later this year. And it was a one-time recording, and I went to see my daughter, and I gave her the recorder, and I guess it was a worthwhile purchase.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that particular interview, Hank, because in a few weeks we're going to celebrate an anniversary here.
Well, actually, we could celebrate it next week, but...
All right.
But no, wait a minute. Not next week. Today. We could have celebrated today,
Congratulations, Hank, on 34 years on the air.
Yeah, but you know what? It's the congratulations should be to the listeners, and it's the listeners we thank. It's the listeners that made it possible.
Indeed. But the reason I mention it is during that recording with Bill Gates, you talked about what would things be like in 25 years.
Well, actually, it was 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, and 30 years.
And guess what? We're now 25, 30 years into it.
Yeah.
Let's see how accurate that recording really was.
I'll tell everyone that it was well over 90%, not quite 100, but it was well over 90. He had the vision, and I'll tell you, he had the patience, okay? Because one of the questions I asked him was, who's number one now? At that time, there was Lotus, there was Ashton Tate, and I said, you're number one now in the software. But I don't look at it that way. I look at where we want to go, and are we on track and getting there? Being number one and number two, if I concentrate on that, I'll never get to where my goal is. That's a very smart businessman.
Yes, it is. But did he tell you what his goal was?
Yes, yes.
And if you listen to this program, Hank, when are you going to put it on the air? 2 weeks or 3 weeks?
Well, I don't know. It's a lot that has to do with timing and so on. And we'll see, okay?
But sometime before the end of the year, Hank will play that out of our archives, that very interesting interview with Bill Gates, and we'll find out whether he's true or full of baloney.
Well, I'll tell you what, he's not full of baloney, considering that in the last 30 years he's been very successful, and if he was full of baloney, he would not be where he is.
Hey, baloney's a very popular lunch meat.
Yeah. Baloney with mustard on it or something?
On white bread with
hey,
American
Joe,
cheese.
Hey, Joe, there was an announcement that IBM made that kind of surprise you, and you say, what's that for? And I looked at it and I said, wait a minute. If you think hard on it, boy, that is some announcement.
And I didn't say what's that for. I said this was a new technology.
No, not new. It's old technology.
This is a new technology which is going to be destructive of a whole new industry.
No, it's not new technology. It's old technology. But what it is that...
Wait a minute. Did this exist 3 weeks ago?
First of all, let's tell the audience what it is. It's if you didn't know, or if you've been in business long enough, as you know, in big businesses, they used tapes, and then they used tapes to do backup on hard drives. And for the longest time, they've been using tapes. And today, they still use tapes.
Hank was really annoyed at me running my business that I did not do a regular daily and weekly backup. And he kept bugging me so much, I finally went out and I bought what was called a jumbo tape drive and a series of jumbo tapes. Hank, how much did those tapes hold?
Well, let me put it this way. They had announced that they are... Well, first of all, in the old days, it used to be in a 12-inch...
I'm talking about these jumbo tapes were cassette tapes that were very small.
I have no idea what it cost them.
And they held
okay.
about 200 megs or 300 megs, maybe
It was definitely less than a gig, okay? It was 250. It was called Jumbo 250.
Jumbo 250, that's right.
250 megabytes.
And I very religiously did all the backups every day and then every week and then every 2 weeks. Just the formula that Hank had given me, I put it up on the blackboard and I checked it off, and then one day I had a crash, and Hank said, no big deal, just go to your last tape, and then you'll...
Just remember, Joe, when we started with floppy drives, they were less than 1 meg.
They were 192 gig. That's what my drive
is. No, not 192 gig. 192
gig is huge. 192K. At any rate, Hank said, just back up the tape. He said, what you do is go to your last full tape and then whatever incrementals you have before. Then he said, it'll probably take you 2 or 3 hours to restore your system. I went in. My tapes were corrupted. And Hank said, well, what were they like the last time you tested them for validity?
You didn't.
And I said, tested them for what? So now we have a new tape, Hank has announced. And when he told me what it was, I said, no, you made the same mistake I always make. You're saying terabytes when you mean gigs.
Well, what it is that IBM announced that they have these tape cartridges. Now, the tape cartridge is, it's really like if you took any data camcorders with these cartridges that you pop in with a tape. It's bigger than that, but think of it as maybe a jumbo size pack of king size cigarettes. Okay.
Yeah, about that.
And up until recently, they were able to store 45 terabytes,
which is a lot more than a gigabyte.
Onto that little tape. Okay.
Now a terabyte is how many gigabytes?
Well, let me put it this way.
That's 1,000.
For most people, on a 2.5-inch drive, you can't get more than 3 or possibly 4 terabytes onto one drive, okay?
That's about right. And a lot of people, Hank, really don't understand the terabyte. A lot of people still don't understand the gigabyte.
Well, because they're not focused on the data, okay? They should. Now, what I want to say is that a typical 2-terabyte hard disk drive goes for about $60-$70. A 3-terabyte goes for about $100. Now, 3 terabytes, okay? Now, what IBM announced is that on this cartridge, the new cartridge is 330 terabytes.
On the same cartridge that's about the size of a king-size pack of cigarettes.
It's almost the size of a 2.5-inch hard disk drive, but thicker. And 330 terabytes. And then I said, gee, well, what's the cost of it? The cost is somewhere around $90, $80 to $90.
In other words, I could go out and buy one for $80 to $90. I don't have to buy 500 at a time.
No, that's quantity one. If you're buying quantity like big corporations, they buy,
It'd be
a lot cheaper, okay?
It's interesting because just a couple of weeks ago, I set up a new backup system for my home, which would include remote access, and I felt I really needed some big storage. So I went out and I bought a Western Digital external drive, which held a full terabyte, and I paid $45 for it.
Yeah, because I talked to some people, and we were talking about backup, and you're talking about cloud computing. Well, cloud computing is really you have your data and or applications remote, and it's sitting at someone else's facility, and realistically, they have to do backup every day, and you don't ask how they do backup, but if you think about it, if they were to back up with like hard drives, that's very expensive. They back up with solid state drives, that's even more expensive. But they can back it up very cheaply now with this very high density tape. Now, IBM also announced that this 330 terabytes that they expect in 3 years to be 4 times that density.
4 times.
That is huge.
But stay with the 300 for just a second. Let's say, and you say it costs about $80-$90 in unit one. Well, let's round it up and say
$100.
Let's call it $100. So you have 330 terabytes for $100. Now I bought a terabyte for $40, rounded off.
Wait, stop right there. Okay, you got to remember with tape, when we used to do tape processing in the '60s. All right. Everything is sequential. If you want something on the middle of the tape, you got to run down to the middle of the tape. You know, it's like watching a beta or VHS movie, okay? You got to, spin it all the way down. Now, with a hard disk drive, you can move to it directly. So you remember, because one of the things that you said to me was, why can't I just use a tape cartridge to run my storage? Well, you can. You can put it on your own home machine. You can set up your own cloud. But just remember, if you use tape, it's going to be a lot longer to process, but a lot cheaper to store.
A lot cheaper. And you would use it only for archival purposes, not where you want to access the databases that are on there every 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Because then going back and forth, even with a binary search, would be a problem. But think about it. I bought $40 one terabyte. That's 330 times 40. I don't know how much that is, but it's a lot more than my allowance was when I was a kid.
Well, we were talking before we got on the air. Joe said that this will kill the cloud business. And I'm saying, no, it will not kill the cloud business. If anything, it will make it run more efficiently. And what is your reasoning why you think it might kill the cloud business?
I
don't think it will, okay?
I can get multi-terabyte storage in the cloud for $100 a month. I can get smaller amounts of storage, gig storage, multiple gig storage, for $10 a month. Or I can set up my own cloud and put in 330 terabytes worth of storage for $100 once over its lifetime.
For backup.
For storage, for what I now have to pay people for storage.
Yeah, again, if you...
I'm not talking your anything that you want to access every hour on the hour. I'm saying people like Amazon and IBM are selling me cloud storage for a high multiple, 10, 15, 20 times what I could do it myself for.
Well, they offer more than that, Joe. I mean, like, I'll give you an example. Like, Microsoft is now the is a leader in cloud storage usage and revenues, okay? And the reason is very simple, is because Office 365 is a cloud product, and if you want to invoke the program, you go to the cloud. You want to store a doc file or a spreadsheet, you go to the cloud.
Hank, I happen to have a license for Office 360 or
365.
365.
That's cloud storage.
And I have I said to them, well, since I'm paying you so much a month. For all that,
it's like $5-6 a month they
for
charge.
All that cloud,
okay,
storage. How about I upload about 400 high definition movies to that storage also? And said, oh no, you can't do that. For that, we'll sell you separate storage. Well, I don't want to pay separate storage, so I'll buy myself one 330 terabyte drive, and I'll have my high definition movies.
I think my point is this: that with Microsoft, Microsoft jumped to number one. They beat out Amazon in terms of cloud storage provider is because Office as a product, reason why a big company want to go to the cloud is that they get the automatic updates for everyone. They don't have to go installing it in each machine.
I agree with you completely. And if I were a Fortune 500 company, I wouldn't think of going to Joe King's basement to keep my storage.
And also, you don't want to put everything in one place.
But I'm not a Fortune 500 company, and this is the personal computing show. We're not talking to people in enterprises.
Wait a minute, but people with personal computers do go to the cloud.
And they shouldn't. They should think about setting up their own. Many, many years ago, 1983, we were on the radio, and one of our colleagues, the late Ross Greenberg, had a product that he felt was really needed. It was called RAMnet. And the purpose of RAMnet was so that he didn't have to worry about all of his original work. He spread it among three or four or different friends, all who had RAMnet. And at the end of each day, person number one filed their stuff on the files of person number two, and person number two on person number three, and so on. And RAMnet, in essence, was the cloud before the word cloud had ever been used.
You say cloud computing is not really personal computing. Chromebook is a perfect example of cloud computing with a Chromebook, okay?
And if you have a Chromebook, you better look for something like that, but I don't recommend buying the Chromebook.
There's one other item that I want to go through, and that's Microsoft will be releasing sometime later this year a new update to Windows 10, and I read about it, and I find it fascinating because they kept referring to WSL, and I put down WSL, and Joe said to me, what the heck is WSL? And it stands for Windows Subsystem for Linux. In other words, you said to me, are they running emulation? No. Simulation? No. Are they running a virtual operating system? No. All they're doing is they're setting aside so that if you want to run one of three versions of Linux, I think Ubuntu is one of them, SUSE is another one, and I can't remember the third one, and it's just separate piece of code that you can run. And the advantage of it is you can share that data. And if you're doing any kind of work where you're doing, let's say, lab work or scientific work where they're using Linux and you got this massive data, hey, guess what? I think Microsoft has a winner there. What do you think?
They very well might. But people don't realize, but Linux, which was developed by Linus Pauling, I tripped over that one.
Torvalds for the kernel,
Linus
just the kernel, though.
Created a kernel, a central part of the software, a kernel which he called Linux, after himself, Linus Torvalds. That's what Microsoft is putting in. Why they're limiting it to those three front ends, I don't know.
Well, they're
using the kernel, in essence, in a sandbox. It doesn't leak out.
See, the word sandbox infer virtual operating system. It's not. It's not a sandbox, okay?
It's an operating system which is not the current operating system.
No, but it doesn't run under. It runs concurrent with it, okay?
Isn't that what a sandbox does?
A sandbox, you run under another one, okay?
Well, now, let me officially state, I'm confused.
I want to answer one of your questions. Why only those three? It's because that is one of the biggest problems with Linux. When Linux was came out in 1992, 1993, everyone was saying, wow, we're going to eliminate Windows. We're going to, they designed it so that you come up with your own flavor of Linux. Guess what? When you come up with your own flavor, it's like saying, you know, Joe, we got 10 people here. Each of you can invent your own language, okay? And what happens is that one Linux is not necessarily interchangeable with another Linux in terms of the interfaces.
No,
that's a problem.
They actually should be, but they're not. People didn't really adhere to the standard. But the kernel on all of these Linuxes is Linux.
Yeah, but you know what? When we say kernel, you know what they really mean when they say kernel?
What do they really mean?
The input-output on how you communicate with peripheral devices.
That's right.
And how you can communicate with other programs called API is another set of it's another kettle of fish to talk about.
It's called an API.
In other words, you got so many derivatives of Linux and so many offshoots of it.
What does the API stand for?
Application Programming Interface.
And the kernel is what you need so that
remember in the old days we called BIOS and BDOS?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's what it meant.
Here we have something that Winston Churchill actually talked about, two peoples separated by a common language.
I guess what? We can have two people separated by the same language, too. we have that.
We try not to do that.
Huh?
Hank?
Can I tell you a perfect example of that? I know you're going to smile when I say it because you wouldn't expect me to say it. Congress.
They don't have any language. Hank, what's going to happen the rest of the show tonight?
Well, we have in the last half hour, we have a couple of segments, and I think that what's interesting is that I spoke to Alfred, and he was telling me that let me just talk about what Alfred's going to be covering. He's talking about wearable tech that can detect drowsiness while you're driving. And I'm
not when your head nods over like the old days.
No. In other words, it's not movement. It's actually wearable that can detect the bio sensors in your body, and based on those changes, it can wake you up. It's interesting. It's fascinating.
It's also safety.
And then the one thing he talked about was the nano robots. You know, these little tiny things. What was it? Fantastic Voyage or Fantastic Journey, or what was it?
I think it was the Fantastic Voyage, where in a nano submarine they traveled through the veins.
Well, what happened was that I was talking to him yesterday, and he said, do you remember that? I said, I can only remember one thing from it. He says, what did you remember from it? I said, Raquel Welch. He says, do you remember anything else? I says, Raquel Welch. You remember that? By the way, that was strictly science fiction. But you know what? Instead of talking about it, why don't we just get to it, okay? Tonight, we have three very interesting presentation segments. The first is by Dr. Alfred Poor. He's going to be talking about wearable tech that can detect sleepiness or drowsiness while you're driving. Another thing he's going to talk about is a free database of all the wearable devices and technologies that you can inquire about. And he also talks about nanoscale robots, small enough to go into your bloodstream to do examination like in Fantastic Voyage. I will be doing a segment on the evolution of the digital camera. And I've asked Marty Winston to do a segment somewhat lightheartedly on spousal approval when you're installing all that equipment for home automation. I asked him, does he get any flack on it? And, well, I listened to it and I was rolling on the floor.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Car crashes are a serious problem for health and expense reasons, can change people's lives. According to the National Highway Safety Administration, there were 72,000 crashes in 2013 that were attributable to a drowsy driver. Of these 72,000 crashes, 44,000 of them resulted in injuries and 800 deaths. So it's a pretty high price to pay for sleepy drivers. Well, wearable technology may be able to help with that. A new company called Creative Mode has come up with a project that they're running on Kickstarter. They've created a wearable called Steer, like you steer your car. What this device is something that you strap on your forearm near your elbow. Basically, it monitors your heart rate and your galvanic skin response, the electrical conductance of your skin. It basically watches for a drop in heart rate. If it detects that your heart rate is slowing, which the company correlates to becoming sleepy, it will flash a yellow light and it will also vibrate to give you an alert to help startle you, wake you up. If it detects that your heart rate slows further, it then issues what the company calls a gentle electric shock, again, with the idea that this will help make you more alert and bring you back to a more awake state. The device is interesting. It's rechargeable with a USB cable and is supposed to have a useful life of about 2 weeks per charge. Now, if this device helps save lives, help reduce crashes, that could be a huge benefit. Save a lot of money, save a lot of lives, and save people a lot of unhappiness. There's no question that the wearable technology market is just exploding, not just for health and medical applications, but fitness and convenience and all kinds of other applications as well. Even for somebody like me who spends a lot of my time trying to keep track of all of these new products as they come along, it's really a mammoth task. And it's hard for any one person to be aware of all the new products that are coming onto the market or that are in development. Fortunately, there's a new resource available to help meet this challenge and help you become more informed about the different wearable technologies that are available. There's a free online reference from a company called Vandrico. And this is so interesting, I'm going to spell that out carefully. That's V like Victor, A-N-D like David, R-I-C-O, Vandrico. They have posted a free online database about wearable products. Go to their website, vandrico.com/wearables, and you get access to the database. The company says that they have 424 devices listed from 266 different companies. I'll be the first to say that this is a great effort and they've made a good start, though I'm pretty certain it's not a totally comprehensive list. However, it's a really good place to start if you're looking for information about wearables for a variety of different applications. It has a database that you can search with a company name if you want. You can get a list of the products in alphabetical order, or if you know a term or the name of something you're looking to find, you can search for that. But it's also got a very cool interface. They put up a silhouette of a human body, and you can click on different body parts, and it will light up and tell you how many different devices are designed for where on that part of the body. For example, if you click on the torso, you'll find that there are 26 devices available for that. You click on the body part that you're interested in, and then you can get a list of the products that apply to that part of the body. Vandrico is a company that helps corporations use wearables for industrial and enterprise applications. They have a business orientation to their view of these products, One of the cool things is that they will provide relative scores for each product based on different factors such as the benefits, connectivity, and their various features. While this has a workplace focus, it still can be useful for other people looking for wearables for other purposes. So if you're trying to find out more about what wearables are available, this is a great place to start. And did I mention that it's free? If you're of a certain age, you may remember a movie called Fantastic Voyage. Though, if you're of the male persuasion, it's quite possible that you don't remember much about the movie other than Raquel Welch in her spacesuit. Basically, the plot line is a bunch of scientists were miniaturized into a submarine and injected into the bloodstream of a patient in order to go and save his life. We may not be able to shrink movie stars at this point to inject them into your body, but we're getting closer in terms of getting robots that can do just that. The researchers at the University of California, San Diego, have created what they call a nanoscale robot that swims. A swimming nanorobot isn't all that new, but most of the ones that have been developed so far rely on sort of a corkscrew, a helical device to help propel them through the fluids or whatever they're located in. Some others use a whip-like appendage that they flail back and forth and move themselves through the liquid that way. Both of these approaches are derived pretty much directly from the way that actual bacteria and single-celled organisms propel themselves. So it's just styled on nature. Well, researchers in San Diego came up with a novel approach. They've actually created a body, a cylindrical body with arms on the end that rotate around. The arms bend at different locations and simulate the motion of a swimmer doing the freestyle stroke. It's able to swim up to 12 of its body lengths in just a second, and it's steerable. It's driven by an oscillating magnetic field, so it can navigate and you can control its speed to go faster or slower. Best of all, the system is much more energy efficient than the other kinds of devices that have been used on some of the nanorobot designs so far. So this is a nanorobot that could be controlled remotely. It could deliver medications to specific locations within the body and possibly do procedures like clear a blood clot in a blood vessel or something like that. So it could provide exciting new tools that could be used to perform medical procedures. And the best news of all is we won't have to shrink any movie stars to make it work. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Since the rise of mirrorless cameras and smartphones, both point-and-shoot and digital SLR sales have suffered rather dramatically. Point-and-shoots peaked at high of around 110 million units shipped in 2008, while just 12.5 million shipped just last year. Digital single-lens reflex fell from a high of just over 16 million units in 2012 to about 8.4 million units in 2016. For their part, mirrorless cameras shipments have also decreased, but much less dramatically, and it's rather flat, going from 3.9 million units to 3.2 million units. Well, what is a digital SLR? It's a camera where the mirror is inside the camera body, and it mirrors the light coming in through the viewpoint or the lens, up to a crystal or a set of extra mirrors and into the viewfinder for you to see what you're shooting. So you can see what you're shooting. When you press the screen button, the mirror flips up and the shutter opens and the light falls onto the picture sensor, which clicks the final image. A mirrorless camera, however, is a little different. The light goes through the lens and right onto the image sensor, which captures and see the picture to display it on the back screen or the LCD screen. A few models likewise offer a moment screen inside that allows you to see through the eye viewfinder. Well, has digital photography really evolved? Yes. Lytro, L-Y-T-R-O, is a camera capable of refocusing images after being taken. Lytro Inc. shipped its first generation pocket-sized camera capable of refocusing images after the picture has been taken, and this was introduced in February 2012. 2 years later, the company announced the Lytro Illum. It's a second-generation camera priced at $1,600. This camera has a permanently attached zoom lens from 30 to 250 millimeter and an F2.0 lens and an articulated rear screen. And in the fall of 2015, Litro changed its direction. They announced the Immerge, I-M-M-E-R-G-E, a very high-end virtual reality video capture camera for studio use. This camera caught an awful lot of attention in the beginning because of its ability to refocus the image after the image has been taken, but for whatever the reasons are, it really never caught on. So what has happened after that? MIT recently announced that it has developed a new machine learning technology that is able to retouch an image in real time, presenting the photographer with a final product before they snap the photo. The automatic image retouching system is lightweight enough to be used on and installed on a regular smartphone, and it can be equipped with multiple different styles. Using machine learning for computational photography is an exciting prospect, but right now it's limited by severe computational and CPU power constraints of mobile phones. In order for the image retouching to work in real time on low power devices like the smartphone, the researchers develop a system that modifies a low resolution version of the final image, then translate those edits to the full resolution photos. With this method arose a big problem, however, namely that the low resolution image doesn't contain enough data to adequately determine edits for the full resolution version. Two different solutions were found to solve this problem. The first being that the system outputs a set of simple formulas rather than the low image resolution itself, and the second being a method for applying the formulas for the full resolution photos. This technology may have a future as it is targeted for the smartphone. Let's hear now from Marty Winston.
In designing our cybernetic 40-year house, there's one reality there. I don't know what came up, but Hank asked me very specifically to address the topic of what we formally call spousal approval. If you're the husband or wife, I don't care. If you have a husband or wife, I don't care. But there's somebody there in the house, someone to whom you have pledged all kinds of stuff, who's going to say, get that ugly thing out of here if you bring in any form of anything that he or she finds objectionable, maybe even offensive if they're playing it to the hilt. The idea of not crossing that line, of not being found ugly, is one that's impacted electronics for a very long time. It was in the 1950s that high fidelity first hit, and high fidelity meant having big speakers. And big speakers lasted for a while until spousal approval said, get that thing out of here, it's not furniture. So the speaker manufacturers worked on making speakers that looked more like furniture. Wonderful, polished woods, but wait a minute. What's that snaky thing on the floor that looks like an electrical wire? Speaker wire? Oh my! And it's not bad enough to have the big wooden blocky speaker and that wire going to it. Now you've got this stack of metal boxes with glowing faces. The whole thing is starting to look like some kind of science lab. You may have heard that argument. I know I've heard it or overheard it. What do you do about it? And didn't we run into all of that again when computers came into our homes? Those old blocky things, that big box that looks a little bit like a TV set but isn't, the metal can next to you, coily wires going to a keyboard, the whole thing a lot bigger than any typewriter, and what are you doing with it? We remember those early computers, they could do a few things, and it was more like validating themselves than being productive for us, but it was a start. It's how we got started. Spreadsheets and word processors and all of that. Well, it took a while for what was happening on the commercial side to catch up with the consumer side, but it happened. But in the meantime, you had modems and phone wires dragging across. You had all kinds of connecting wires. And you had that spousal approval kick in again, which is why so many of those computers ended up in what? Basements? How about yours? Your early days? Where was it? Was it in a den by yourself with a door that closed? It sure as heck was not in the living room. very rarely in the dining room, and then not for long, spousal approval kicked it out. It wasn't allowed where real furniture could live. Spousal approval would not let that happen. So, what's next? Well, you remember what happened with home theater, this big fake theater thing you'd put in your home? Now you had just stacks and racks of equipment that would have to hide in a closet that the carpenters came in to add because you had to hide it. You had to hide it. Spousal approval wouldn't allow it in the rest of the house. And how many of those home theaters do you think have been torn apart since? I guess we found we didn't need them as much as we thought we did. Spousal approval. Now, all of this relates today to the issue of home automation. And there has never been a bigger blight of little cubes, little disks, little things stuck all over the place. How many things are plugged into outlets? How many things are hanging on walls? How many things are under a desk, on a desk? In fact, let's take the formal stuff. Let's just consider the stuff that everybody loves. What's this thing on the table that looks a little bit like, I don't know, a dog food can? Oh, wait, it's Alexa. Isn't that a fun thing? It's a novelty. I can talk to it, and sometimes it gets it right and something happens. Hey, Alexa, what are you doing? How many of your Alexas did I just trigger? It's there. You know, it's there, and it's taking space, and it's intruding on the visual field. And the example of Alexa is, I mean, Alexa is a fun thing, and I wouldn't regard it as, I mean, it's an interesting novelty. How about all those little home, they call them security, they're really home surveillance cameras or the nanny cams. Those little, well, it looks like a puck on a stick half the time. Those little blobs of things that have to be on bookshelves or mantles or on tables and all of that. Those little things that have intruded on your living space because now you can remote control something with your smartphone. Isn't that why most of them are there? Really? Is that what you're doing? I wouldn't wait for the spouse. I disapprove of that. In fact, I do disapprove of that. So let's give the answer to spousal approval. And the answer is, drum roll, the answer is invisibility. Don't put it out on the table. Don't drape wires down the wall. Don't do anything that intrudes in the visual space of the room. Don't be there. Masquerade. Make it invisible. Great example, EcoVent. EcoVent is a motorized vent curtain that goes on your ventilation ducts. An EcoVent system has a little square thing that you connect over where your router is. It wirelessly connects to these vent covers, they're motorized vent covers. And it also has, in each room that has one of these motorized vent covers, plugged into the wall outlet, a temperature sensor that reports back over the same wireless connection. And that doesn't need a battery. The vent thing does, but it lasts a good long time. What we have now is something that takes the space of its predecessor, doesn't look that so much dramatically different that anybody will say, wow, that looks like a cow's face. No, it's a good thing. That's an example of being invisible or masquerading to be in the space. Now, okay, you know I'm designing a cybernetic house. You know that that means thousands of sensors, more than 100 actuators, almost 100 controllers. How do you hide all that? Well, there's a device in every house, in your house, in every commercial building, and everywhere. A small device called a standard two-gang electrical box. If you have two pair of outlets next to each other, it's in a two-gang electrical box. If you have, and it's a square one, you know, if it's only got two outlets, it's long. If it's got a two-by-two, it's square, and that's what we're talking about. If you have two light switches next to each other, it's in the same kind of box. You may have a box on the ceiling, which, you know, is there for any number of things, probably lights, but could be there so you can wire in a smoke alarm, for example. Well, I've gone to that box in 30 places in the house design to hold a Raspberry Pi a thermal mapping sensor, and a number of other sensors, relays, and it all fits. It all fits in this little box, and the box connects invisibly up in the attic or down in the crawl space with Ethernet wire and with 14.4, essentially expanded speaker wire that I use to deliver DC power to it so I don't have to worry about babysitting the batteries. Why is that better? Because it's not ugly. Because you don't get a spouse saying, get that ugly thing out of the house. Because it's not a white blob that looks like the wall has pimples. Because it's not eating every outlet with another little wall wart cube in it. Because it's not intruding on the visual space. And the home automation category isn't figuring that out. But your spouse is way ahead of all that. So where are you? You can't buy what I'm doing. I'm building it. I'm hand-tooling it. You don't have to buy what they're doing. And if you give them some pressure, maybe they'll think about making it more subtle, more invisible. Now, one other thing that's invisible that will always, always have a warm place here is the idea that you need a place to make a backup and a backup and a backup. Am I right, Hank? Back to you.
And thank you, Marty. You made my day. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on video and audio editing Thursday, August the 10th at 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building, Room 411, 31 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have a presentation on CAD on the Mac and iPad with virtual reality. Meetings on Friday, August the 11th at 7 p.m. They meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a meeting on tips for staying safe online, preventing ransomware and identity theft, Thursday, August the 24th, 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on astrophotography, Tuesday, September the 5th, 7:30 p.m., Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on passwords, passwords, and passwords. How LastPass can help. Tuesday, September the 5th, 1:30 p.m. at the Community Room located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, September the 12th, 7:15 p.m. at the Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor in West Nyack. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a presentation on AT&T Digital Life Home Automation Friday, September the 15th, 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public and there is no charge to attend, and hopefully we'll be seeing you there. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and keep cool until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.